Okay. Lecture S9, October 25th, 1962, Electricity in the Atmosphere. Lecture S9, October 25, 1962, Electricity in the Atmosphere. Lecture S9, October 25th, 1962, Electricity in the Atmosphere.
Yeah. I had an important item on the tail end of the last lecture, which I wish to say, and so I stick it into this lecture, and the result will be that this lecture will leave an important item that I want to say at the end, but what can you do? In the formula for energy, which was all written out on the blackboard last lecture, and I've just written it over again, we started with the idea that the interaction between, with the energy of interaction between two charges was the product of the charges over the distance. We ended up concluding that by mathematics that it must be equal to the square of the electric field from the other point of view that there's energy in the field. But from the point of view that there's energy in the field, let us calculate the energy of a single point charge. The field goes radially inversely as the square of the distance, so the square of the field goes inversely as the fourth power of the distance. And the volume element is r squared dr. So we find ourselves integrating dr over r squared, which integrates to 1 over r. Now, at infinity, that's all right, but we're supposed to integrate for a point charge to the origin, and thus we find that the field energy of a point charge is infinite. What's wrong? How can anything be here? You see, there's no such difficulty on this side, but on this side, there is an infinity. And the answer is that the equation going from here to here is only valid if the charges are distributed and is not valid if they are strictly a point. Because what's missing over here, that is included over here, is the interaction of a charge with itself. There should be added to this, to really make it exactly equal to this, mathematically speaking, the square of a single charge divided by this distance between it and itself, which is, of course, evidently zero, and which is we're trying to calculate back over here. In other words, the idea that the energy is located in the field is inconsistent with the idea that charges are point charges. One possibility would be that the electron is not a point but is a little distribution of charge. The other is that the whole theory is wrong. This difficulty has never been solved and exists to this day. I wish to discuss it, however, in more detail of the various ramifications and attempts to solve it when we know a little bit more about the other things, such as the momentum in the field and other things by which I'll be able to make a more complete description of the difficulties of this. But I wanted to mention when I got here that we have done something to ourselves in going from here to here and therefore to there. We've included the self-action of the charges, which is infinite and should have been in that sum from this point of view. All right. Now I start the lecture for today, which is on electricity in the atmosphere. On an ordinary day in a desert country or flat country or over the sea or anywhere, the voltage, the potential above the ground is higher than on the level of the ground by about 100, well, it varies, but say 100 volts per meter. That means that at the height of 2 meters, which is where your nose is, the voltage is 200 volts higher than the ground where your feet are. And if this is supposedly true, your first question is, why don't I just take a pair of electrodes and stick them out there, and I got 110 volts with a meter apart, and I can run lights. And secondly, if there were this big difference of 200 volts between my nose and my feet, how is it I don't get a shock when I go out in the street? And the answer is, of course, the following, that if this represents the human being, which is a conductor, then since he's in contact with the ground, the whole surface is in equipotential. And although before, if these represent the surfaces of 100 volt, 200 volt, 300 volt levels, where zero is the potential of the earth, well, if you put the man there, of course, the equipotential is distorted, and it gets something like this. And of course, you still have a zero voltage, relatively speaking, between the head and the feet. And the reason is that the charges in the earth can come up and fill up their head. Very little current is required for that because it takes not much charge to fill your head. The charge on the Earth's surface is negative. That is, the sign of the field is so that the charge on the Earth's surface is negative. How can we measure such a charge? How is it known to be true if every time you put an instrument in there, you get into trouble? The answer is there's two ways. There are several ways, but let me explain two. One way is to put a conductor here, an electrode here, say, which was originally connected to the ground, and then the equipotentials get distorted, and then you disconnect it. It doesn't make any difference. The equipotentials remain distorted. It turns out if you wait an infinite, a very long time, there's a little bit of conductivity in the air, and gradually this will approach the potential of the air, and then you could measure the voltage with a very delicate electrometer. You can speed up the process very much, however, this way. When it was connected to the ground, negative charges were on it, so it's charged negatively. One way to find this out would be to bring it back to the ground and measure a shift in potential when you bring the plates close together. Another way to measure it is to let water be in here and let the water drop out. Now, when the water drops are negative, you see, and when they drop off, they carry off negative charge. And after a number of drops drop off, it gradually approaches the right potential for the place in question. And then you can measure the potential. Finally, another way to measure the potential is the simple trick. If there's an electric field, then there's a charge on the Earth's surface. So you isolate a plate, a metal plate, which is first connected to the Earth so that negative charge appears on it and it has the field lines parallel to everywhere else on the Earth. Then you take this thing. Well, one easy way is to cover it with a shield, leaving it insulated during that process from the Earth. Then it's got a negative charge, but if you now connect the wire to the Earth, the charge will go off because it's inside a box and will carry no charge ultimately. So in other words, if I shield this thing, first I expose it, then I shield it, then I can measure a voltage difference to the shield. So they have machines that turn, you know, that shield the plates automatically and so on, but that's various ways of measuring this field. Incidentally, in mentioning the charge carried by drops, I realized that I forgot to explain the thunderstorm machine that we had here before, the electrostatic machine with water currents. And so I will quickly explain that. This picture outlines again what was involved. There was a couple of shower heads and some cans, which didn't even touch the shower heads. And then there were some cans down here, which collected with the water, had a touch to go through. And all there was that this one was connected to this one, and this one was connected to this one. Now, let's suppose that by some accident of life, and it's important, you can't get the answer unless you suppose that this starts with some irregularity or inequality, that this side is, say, a little bit positive and this is a little bit negative. Of course, that means, since these were connected, that this is also positive. Now, what happens? If this is positive, as the drops, because of the positive charge in here, negative charge is induced on the shower head. And as the drops form them, negative charge appears on the surface of those drops, which are at the surface of the shower head. You know, the charge is all on the surface. So as the drops come off, they take off the surface, if I may be so bold as to describe it that way, and carry away negative charge. So as they fall down here and they touch the metal can, they deliver their charge to the can because it's on the inside that you're touching, and the charge runs to the outside of the conductor and beyond. And so it runs out, and this can becomes negative and runs over to here, which was originally negative. Of course, what's happening on the other side is the same thing with positive. So this can gets positive, which drives it still more positive, and this one gets negative, it drives it still more negative. So once started, it just builds itself up, and that's how it works. Now, to continue on our discussion of the field of the Earth, however, in the atmosphere, measurements of this field show, first of all, that it's really, in most cases, very variable, that it continues to exist as you go up in altitude, but that it decreases as you go up. It gets weaker and weaker as you go up, and you can integrate the total potential. Even though you can't go to infinity, the field is getting so weak that you finish with the integral, and you find that the top of the world is 400 kilovolts higher than the surface of the Earth. The top of the sky is 400 kilovolts higher than it. Now, the next thing that you can try to determine is not just the potential, but whether any current arrives at such a plate. And you find indeed that a very small current in the neighborhood of 10 micro-microamperes appear on a plate a square meter. Now, where can such a current come from? Air is an insulator, is it not? Not real air. The real air is not an insulator, but apparently it is slightly conducting. And it's because of this conductivity that there's a small amount of current that passes from the sky down to the earth, because in the field that we have just been describing of 100 volts per meter. Where do the conductivity come from? Here and there among the air atoms, there's an ion, one which has acquired an extra electron, one molecule, say, of oxygen or something, which has acquired an extra electron, and perhaps another that has lost one, here and there. These do not really stay as single molecules. They usually accumulate one or two molecules, or perhaps four or five molecules around them, so the ion's a little bit of a lump because the charge attracts the other atom. But these things then can drift in the field slowly, going up and going down, discharging the field of the Earth. Where do the ions come from? The first guess as to where the ions came from was the radioactivity of the Earth. It was known in the early days of the century that there was radioactivity and that the rays that came out ionized air. And the way they did it was that, for example, fast particles, like beta rays, coming out of the nuclei could, in moving so fast through the atoms, tear off electrons off the atoms and leaving some behind, in other words, with charges. This would imply, of course, that if I went up in the air, higher and higher, I would get less and less ions per cubic centimeter because the radioactivity is all in the dirt and the ground, radium and uranium and this and that. And so they carry the experiments up in balloons to measure the ionization of the air and discovered that it was the opposite, that the ionization increased per unit volume as you go up in altitude. This was a very mysterious thing and was the most dramatic moment in the entire history of atmospheric electricity. So dramatic it was that it required a branching off of an entirely new subject so that atmospheric electricity remained less dramatic. That is the theory, the phenomenon of cosmic rays. These things, well, obvious ionization was evidently being produced by something outside the Earth, and the investigation of those led to the discovery, or was the discovery, of cosmic rays, and so the physics split again into cosmic rays and atmospheric electricity. So we're not discussing the cosmic rays now, but just say that they're what maintain the supply of ions. In spite of the fact that they're drifting away, new ones are being created all the time by the cosmic ray particles coming from the outside. To be definite, these are not the only kind of ions that there are. There are also pieces of dirt that could be best described as sometimes called nuclei, little pieces of stuff, which are much finer than pieces of dust. For example, in a wave breaks in the sea, there's a little bit of spray, and the spray evaporates, and there's an infinitesimal crystal of sodium chloride left to float in the air. So there are these lumps of dirt, which are sometimes called nuclei, but they're not nuclei of atoms, of course. And they can become charged also. They can pick up these charges. And these also become ions, and those are called large ions. These small ions, these things, are most mobile. That is, they move most when there's an electric field because they're so small. They move with a speed of about 1 centimeter per second in a field of 100 volts per centimeter, or in a field of 100 volts per meter, or 1 volt per centimeter. Roughly, that's a rough figure, that they move about that fast in such a vault. But these much bigger and heavier ones move very much slower. Now, if you're in a region where there are many more nuclei, they'll pick up the other ions, they'll pick the charges off the other ions, and since they move so slowly in a field, the conductivity is reduced. Therefore, the conductivity of air is very sensitive and very variable, depending upon how much of this dirt there is in it. And this dirt is enormously greater in the neighborhood of on land, where there's winds that bring up dust, and especially near cities where there's all kinds of junk thrown into the air, and then it changes very enormously the conductivity from day to day, from moment to moment, from place to place. And that is why the voltage observed here on the Earth's surface at any particular place by one of these instruments varies very rapidly, varies from day to day in enormous amounts. It's due to the changing conductivity. Because if there's a general current flowing down in different places and you suddenly produce an insulation here,
So to speak, the charges begin to pile up and the voltage rises in order to let the current through. So the voltage at the Earth's surface is very variable. But if you measure the current arriving on the Earth, that's far less variable. That's much more the same from place to place and from time to time. But the potential gradient varies very much. The conductivity of the air, which is due to the drifting of the ions here, this is at sea level, increases very rapidly with altitude for two reasons. First of all, the ionization increases. But even more so, the density of air is going down, and the mean free path of the ions is increasing, and so they can travel further in an electric field before they have a collision, and the conductivity of air rises rapidly as you go up. Now, there's only a few microamperes per square meter, but there's an awful lot of square meters on the Earth's surface, and the total electric current reaching the Earth at any time is 1,800 amperes. So we have a supply of voltage of 400,000 volts with 1,800 amperes coming down. But of course, with such a large current, the negative charge on the Earth, the current that's coming down, of course, is positive, the negative charge on the Earth would soon be discharged. In fact, it takes only between a half an hour and an hour, if you figure it out, to discharge the entire Earth. So this thing, however, has lasted more than the first half an hour since it's been discovered. And therefore, the problem is, how is it maintained? Who maintains the voltage between what and the Earth? So we go in a little more detail. If the Earth is here, is minus. And up in the air, the voltage is positive. If you go high enough, the conductivity is so great that horizontally, there's no more room for any voltage variation. The material becomes effectively, for the scale of times and things that we're talking about, a conductor. This is in the neighborhood of 50 kilometers. It's not as high as what's called the ionosphere, in which there are many extra ions produced by photoelectricity from the sun. But it's lower than that. But nevertheless, it's so, for these purposes, I mean, for atmospheric electricity, it's so conducting that we can imagine that there's a surface, a perfect conductor practically, up some great height, and then there's the currents coming down. And the problem is, how is that charge maintained there? How is it pumped back? Because it comes to the Earth, it's got to be pumped back. That's the puzzle. That was one of the greatest puzzles of atmospheric electricity for quite a while. One of the other points is this, that if I measure the current, which is more stable than the potential gradient, over the sea, say, or in careful conditions and average very carefully so I get rid of the irregularity, I discover that there's a daily variation in it. See, each piece of information gives a clue as to the origin, or at least tells you something about it. There's a daily variation that the potential, for example, varies by plus or minus 15%. The current varies plus or minus 15% during the day, and is largest at 7 p.m. in London. The strange part of the thing is that it's largest at 7 p.m. in London, even here. I don't mean it's largest 7 p.m. when you measure in Los Angeles, but it's largest at 7 p.m. in Los Angeles. No, in Los Angeles it's largest when it's 7 p.m. in London. And it's in Madras it's largest when it's 7 p.m. in London. It's always largest when it's 7 p.m. in London, and it's smallest when it's 4 a.m. there. In other words, it depends upon the absolute time on the Earth and not the local time at the place of observation. This is not mysterious this is a check on the idea that there's a very high conductivity laterally at the top, because it can only mean that the total voltage on the, you see, it would be impossible for the voltage difference from the ground to the top to vary locally if there's this high conductivity. It must be worldwide, and indeed it is. What we now know, therefore, is that the voltage at the top surface is dropping and rising by 15% with the time on the Earth, and not locally, of course. And what is the origin of this? Where comes the currents of negative electricity which arrive on the surface of the Earth to keep charging it up negatively? And also some positive currents to go to the other thing. Where are the batteries that do this? I give you a picture of the battery in the next slide. That's the battery. It turns out that the discharges of lightning are not discharges of this potential that we've been talking about. That is, the Earth is negative, and so ultimately the negative charge runs up. That's discharging all the time quietly. But the lightning is the other way around. When a lightning bolt strikes, 10 to 1, it's bringing down negative charge to the Earth in large amounts. It's therefore in the thunderstorms throughout the world, where the lightning is striking, that the currents, the charges, are being brought back to the Earth, which charges it up, and which slowly discharges during the fair weather. And this discharge, which we have been discussing, of 1,800 amperes everywhere. Now the lights, please. It turns out that you can imagine then that the thunderstorms all over the Earth are like a 3,000, it turns out about, battery cells working, pumping up the electricity of this layer, which maintains the voltage difference. And because of the geography of the Earth, due to the characteristics that there are thunderstorms in the afternoon in Brazil and the tropical thunderstorms in Africa and so forth, people have made estimates of the worldwide estimates of how much lightning is striking at any time. And needless to say, it agrees more or less with the voltage difference, that the lightning, that the total amount of thunderstorm activity is highest on the whole Earth at about 7 p.m. in London. However, the thunderstorm measurements or estimates are very difficult to make and were made after it was known that the variation should occur. And these things are very difficult because, you see, we don't have enough observations on the seas and all over to really take the total amount of thunderstorms accurately. But those people who think they do it right obtain a result that agrees with the idea that there's more activity at 7 o'clock after Greenwich Mean Time. Now, in order to understand how these batteries work, we have to look into detail into a thunderstorm and what's going on inside a thunderstorm. And so I'm going to describe that as much as it is known as we get into these marvelous phenomena of real nature and not the idealized spheres of perfect conductors that are inside of other spheres that we can solve so neatly. We discover that we don't know very much, that it's really quite exciting, and anybody who's been in a thunderstorm has enjoyed it or have been frightened, at least an emotion has resulted. And in those places in nature where we get emotions, we'll find it's really has a corresponding complexity and mystery about it, and that it is not going to be possible for me to tell you exactly how a thunderstorm works, exactly how it works, because it's very interesting, and we do not yet know very much. But I tried to describe a little bit about what happens. In the first place, a real thunderstorm seems to be made up of a number of cells fairly close together, and that is best analyzed, they're almost independent of each other, and it's best analyzed one cell at a time. By cells, I mean in a vertical, in a horizontal direction. There's a limited area, and there's another one here, and another one here, and in each one, about the same thing is happening, perhaps in a different timing, but there are certain cells. So we talk about the thunderstorm cell. And the picture on the next slide indicates, in a very idealized fashion, what such a cell looks like in the early stage of the thunderstorm. It turns out that in a certain place in the air, under certain conditions, which I'll describe in a moment, there's a general rising of the air with higher and higher velocities near the top. And as the air, which is a little bit moist here, it's really moist and relatively warm air, it's warm air rising, which is moist. As it rises, it condenses more and more because it cools as it goes up and condenses. And these little crosses indicate snow and the dots indicate rain. But it doesn't snow and it doesn't rain because the updraft currents are great enough and the drops are small enough that they're kept blown up. You see, they don't come down in this stage. This is the first stage. It's not the beginning stage and not the real thunderstorm yet, in the sense that we don't have anything on the ground. At the same time as it's rising, incidentally, an important point which is neglected for many years is that there's an entrainment of air from the sides. I mean, it's not just the air from below, but it entraps a certain amount of other air from the side. Now, if I might have the lights, I'd like to explain how it comes about that the air rises like this. As you know, hot air rises. As you know also, as you go up in altitude, the air is colder. the top of the atmosphere, the ground is heated by the sun, and the light, the radiation to the sky comes from water vapor high in the atmosphere, so that the top of the air, or high in the air, is cold, very cold, while lower down, it's warm. So you say, that's very simple. Warm air rises, and therefore it's unstable mechanically. Of course, if the temperature is different at different heights, it's unstable thermodynamically, but that we know already. I mean, it's not a question of motion. It's just that left to itself infinitely, it would get to the same temperature, but it's not left to itself. The sun is always shining. So the problem is not thermodynamic in equilibrium, but mechanical equilibrium. So we plot here the height and here the temperature, and we find, say, under ordinary circumstances, a curve something like this. As your height goes up, the temperature goes down. Now, why can it be stable? Why doesn't the hot air down here, in any circumstance, simply rise up into the cold air? And the answer is this. As it goes up, the pressure goes down. So if we consider a parcel of air going up, as it goes up, it expands adiabatically. That is, no heat coming in and out. The whole volume of air expands and cools in the process. So if we, in fact, imagine that we took a piece of air up from here to here, it's to a certain height, its temperature would fall due to adiabatic cooling and, in fact, would be colder than the environment under ordinary stable circumstances. In spite of the fact that the air is colder up here, there will not be a turnover, because bringing air from down here to up here, it will cool to a lower temperature than the air there, will therefore be heavier than the air there, and would like to come down again. You know, you have to do work to do that. On the other hand, and so on a good, bright day with very little humidity, there is a certain rate at which the atmosphere falls, which is still stable, which could be quite a rapid decrease of temperature. On the other hand, if the parcel of air contains a lot of moisture, a lot of water vapor, then as it's carried up in the air, although it expands and tends to cool, it cools all right, but as it cools, the water condenses. And as you know, water condensing liberates some heat. It therefore does not cool anywhere nearly as rapidly as it would if it were dry. So if we have air which is wetter than the average air in the neighborhood, and it starts to rise, although I draw the line at which it will rise, what is in the sense called adiabatic line, it would rise along a line like this. That is, it won't keep its temperature fixed. It'll cool off, but not as much as it should if it were dry. So if we have some region of warmish air and some just little push of some kind to get it started, then as it goes up, it finds itself lighter and warmer than the air in the environment, and it continues to go up to enormous heights. And that's the machinery which makes this thing rise. For many years, it was described simply in this manner, but measurements showed that the temperature of the cloud is at different heights was nowhere near as high as indicated by this line. And the reason is that as it went up, it entrained air from the environment, and so it was much closer to the original line because it's mixing with the air that's there. So it's carrying a lot of air up, and it gets to a temperature distribution in the cloud that looks more or less like that. Now, after a while, this goes higher and higher, and we see in the next slide the condition that occurs in what's called a mature thunderstorm. It works like this. Here you see the very rapid updrafts, which in this stage now have carried us up to 40,000 feet. The storms can sometimes go higher. Of course, as you know, there are clouds with all the condensation. There are big clouds that climb way up out of the general cloud bank. This updraft usually is about 60 miles an hour. Then what happens is that there's a lot of condensation of snow, and surprisingly enough, not all the water drops freeze. As water vapor is carried up and the tiny drops condense, they get to temperatures. You see here is 0 degrees where it should freeze, but it doesn't freeze immediately. It keeps on going up. It's trying to get a nucleus for freezing, and it becomes supercooled water. In fact, it doesn't. But if it touches in an equilibrium with ice, though, and if there's anywhere with a nucleus, like a piece of sodium chloride or something, to start this thing, then it'll freeze into a little piece of ice or a snowflake. Then the equilibrium is this way. The water drops evaporate and the ice condenses. So there's a rapid, at a certain point, there's a rapid disappearance of the water and a rapid accumulation of the ice. Also, perhaps there are collisions directly between the water drops and the ice, and the moment there's such a collision, then the water, which is super cool, finds some crystals on which to grow and just grows. So the ice rapidly grows at a certain point in this expansion. So when the thing gets to a certain point, there's a rapid accumulation of large ice particles, which then begin to fall by their own weight. They no longer can be maintained in the updraft. And so as they come down, it is said that they draw a little air with them and produce a downdraft. However, it's easy to point out, it's been pointed out, that once the downdraft is well started, it maintains itself. That is, it drives itself down now. Now, I'll explain the reason for that. If we have a certain amount, you remember that this curve of actual distribution of temperature in the cloud is not as steep as the wet, as the curve would be for just wet air. But now we have wet air, and as it comes down, it goes down this way and can come below the temperature of the environment if it gets down far enough. And the moment it does that, it's denser than the environment and continues to fall rapidly. So that at this stage, once the downdraft gets to here, it continues to drag down. You say, that's perpetual motion. First of all, you argue that the air should rise, and then when you got it up there, you argue equally well that the air should fall. And this perpetual motion, at first looked at as perpetual motion, but then from another point of view, it's in fact very simple. If you claim that a situation is unstable and that warm air should rise, it's equally true something has to replace the warm air, and it's equally true energetically that cold air coming down would energetically replace the warm air, so it isn't perpetual motion. But you realize that what's coming down in this argument must not be the original air. So the original arguments that had a particular cloud without entrainment going up and then coming down had some kind of a puzzle. And they needed the rain to maintain the downdraft, which is hard to believe. But as soon as you realize that there's a lot of original air mixed up with this, and the thermodynamic argument here shows it, that then there, of course, is the downcoming of this cold air, which was originally at some great height. So as there's warm air going up, there's also cold air ultimately coming down. And so we have this picture here of the active thunderstorm. As the thing comes down, of course, the rain comes out of the bottom of the thunderstorm. In addition to that, the cold, relatively cold air, these dotted lines represent the actual temperature. And you see it's low in this region where the downdraft is, because cold air is being brought down from above. And this cold air, this draft, of course, gets spread when it comes to the Earth's surface. So before the rains come, there's a certain little wind that indicates that we're coming near, that as this thing drifts past us, we're getting an indication that a storm is coming. In the storm itself, there are rapid and irregular gusts of air. There's an enormous turbulence in the cloud, and so on. But anyhow, we have an updraft, downdraft, and a rather complicated thing. The lightning arises at the moment that the precipitation begins. At the moment in which the thing starts to precipitate is the same moment in which the large downdraft begins, and is the same moment, in fact, in which the electrical phenomena arise. Just to finish the story of the thing, though, let us see what happens to the thunderstorm at the end of about a half an hour to an hour, the thunderstorm cell. There's no more warm air in the next slide. There's no more warm air any longer, enough warm air to supply the updraft. The updraft stops. The down precipitation continues for a while, the last little bits of water coming out, and the thing gets quieter and quieter. Although there's very high, there's a little bit of, there are small ice crystals left way up in the air, and because of the fact that the winds at very great altitudes are in different directions, the top of the cloud spreads into an anvil shape. It's very common. It spreads very widely at that height. It's the top of the cloud. But for our purposes, the most important question for our purposes, the development of the electrical charges. And experiments of various kinds, including flying airplanes through thunderstorms, the pilots who did this were brave men, tell us that the charge distribution of thunderstorms is somewhat as in the next slide. Don't forget, it's not a whole storm, it's just one of the cells. It appears that the top of the thunderstorm is positive and that the bottom of the thunderstorm is negative, except for a small region, a local region of positive charge, which is caused in the bottom of a cloud, which has caused everybody a lot of worrying. They don't know why it's there, and I don't either, of course. But why it's there, or how important it is, whether it's a secondary effect of the positive rain coming down, or whether it's an essential part of the machinery. But the simpler it would be if it didn't have this situation would be to have negative charge at the bottom and positive charge at the top, which you see is correct for be a battery to drive the Earth negative. Because if we do get a stroke of lightning which will discharge this cloud, and incidentally the voltages involved are the order now of 20, 30, maybe 100 million volts difference between the there and the Earth, and the lightning strike, therefore, will go that way and not the 400 kilovolts, which was the 100 volts per meter before. It doesn't amount to anything. And much greater fields under a thunderstorm. And they're reversed inside. And so negative charge comes down in lightning strokes from this thunderstorm. The positive charges are 6 or 7 kilometers up in the air, and the center is usually approximately at the level of minus 20 degrees centigrade, or according to one people, one slide. But this slide happens to say the other. People don't quite agree as to what exactly is the situation when the negative charges are 3 or 4 kilometers high or at the level between 0 and minus 10 degrees centigrade. Now I'd like to describe the character of the lightning to some extent, to tell you something about it. First of all, when the lightning, there's all these charges around, so there are voltage differences and the air breaks down and there are lightning strokes between one piece of the cloud and another piece of the cloud, or one cloud and another cloud, and also between the cloud and the Earth. With the discharges between the cloud and the Earth, between independent discharge flashes, I mean the main lightning strokes as you see by the eye, there is approximately 20 coulombs or 30 coulombs brought down. The question is, how rapidly does the charge on the 20 or 30 coulombs which are taken away from the thunderstorm cloud, how long does it take for the cloud to regenerate the 20 or 30 coulombs? This can be seen by measuring the electric field far from a cloud, because there's a big dipole there, and by measuring how you suddenly see the dipole fall when the lightning strikes, and then rise back again exponentially, with a time constant, which is slightly different for different cases, but is in the neighborhood of 5 seconds. There's approximately 4 amperes of current then in a thunderstorm in the generating machinery in a thunderstorm. It only takes a thunderstorm 5 seconds after each lightning stroke to build its charge up again. That doesn't necessarily mean that another stroke is going to occur immediately in 5 seconds every time, because of course the geometry has changed and so on and so on, and the strokes are more irregular. But the important point is that it takes about 5 seconds to get itself back into original condition. This means that any model which is made to explain how this storm generates its electricity has to be one with plenty of steam. I mean, it's a real effect. It's a big, rapidly operating device. Before I go into that, I would like to talk about something which is probably, almost certainly, completely irrelevant, but interesting. And this shows the effect of electric field on drops. Why I say it's irrelevant is because I have an experiment, going to have an experiment here in which we have a stream of water, and we show the rather strong effects of an electric field on the stream of water. In a thunderstorm, we do not have a stream of water. We have condensing ice and drops of water. And the question of the right mechanisms in a thunderstorm may not at all be relevant to what I show here. However, I would like to show the importance of an electric field to a stream of water. I hope you're not getting too wet in the second row. As the water comes out of the stream here, it soon, in this region, breaks into drops, which, if everything is right, will fall on the pan so you can hear the drops. Now, if I put on a small electric field, don't touch anything, so any change is known to be due to the electric field. If you listen carefully You'll see some effect. No? I don't know. Could you see it or did it hear it? It's much more sprayed now, and when you make a small field, it collects together better. The drops are larger. If you make a stronger field, then the drops are sprayed much worse. You see, it begins to separate way back here, whereas without that, it separates higher up. So we find that with a very weak electric field already, there's a tendency for the stream not to separate into drops so much. With a stronger field, it gets worse. The explanation of that is probably the following. If we have the stream of water coming out of the nozzle and rapidly breaking into drops in this region, then we put a small electric field here. This side of the water gets plus slightly, and this side gets minus, suppose. Then when it breaks up into drops, one part of the water drops, the ones that are broken from this side may be positive, and the ones from this side are negative, and these drops attract each other, and so they have a tendency to stick together more than they would have before, and so the drops, the stream doesn't spread as much. On the other hand, if the field is stronger, and you have much more positive charge here, then the charge in each of these drops is so much higher, and there are so many, there's a tendency for the charge itself to help to break up the drops because of their own repulsion. And there are many little drops, even the little drops have appreciable charge, and they're all pushed apart much more rapidly. So as I increase the field, the thing is separated more rapidly. The point is, though, that under certain circumstances, electric fields can have considerable influences on the drops, on the charges. The exact machinery by which something happens in a thunderstorm is not at all known and is not at all necessarily in any way related to what I show you there. In fact, nobody has a theory that's based on that idea. But I would like to describe two theories which have existed for the description of the separation of the charge in a thunderstorm. The first one is an older one called the breaking drop theory. Somebody discovered that if you have a drop of water and it breaks into two pieces in a wind stream, then there's positive charge in the water and negative charge in the air. Incidentally, it's clear all we need to do is to, what we need to, what all the theories involve is the idea that there should be some charge on the precipitation particles and a different charge in the air. And then by the movement of the precipitation particles, the water or the ice, through the air, there's a separation of electric charge. And most all the theories have that general idea. The question is, how does the separation begin? I mean, the charging of the drops begin. This theory has several disadvantages, among which the sign is wrong, which is the most serious. And second, most of the precipitation in the large number of temperate zone thunderstorms, which do exhibit lightning, the precipitation effects are in ice and not in water. However, that's part of the possible theory. I mean, that's one of the things that people have thought of. I might mention from what we just saw that if we had some way, theoretical way, for example, that the charge would be different at top and bottom of a drop, and if for some other reason in the high-speed stream it could be shown that the drops would separate into a large one in the front and a smaller one in the back because of the motion through the air or something, again, we would have a theory, which is a different theory, because in this case, small one wouldn't fall as fast as the big one through the air because of the air resistance, and we'd again get a separation. And so you can concoct all kinds of possibilities. One of the more ingenious ones that's more satisfactory in many respects than the breaking drop theory, I am only describing two out of about 8 or 10 different possible theories, is a theory due to Wilson, which I will illustrate as Wilson did, C.T.R. Wilson did, with water drops, although the same phenomena would work with ice. Suppose we have a water drop that's falling, and remember that there's an original electric field. There's the electric field of the 400 kilovolts, the drop to the earth. There's the original regular electric field in which the earth is negative, and therefore the bottom of the drop is positive and the top of the drop is negative. Now, there are in the air slow ions due to those nuclei that we were talking about before. The fast ions don't have an important effect here, but the slow ones do.
Relatively, the drop is moving down through the water, through the air. And if there are small ions here, say positive ones, large ions, they move slowly, you see. The large ions move slowly. The drop comes down, the large ion comes near the drop from the bottom. Let's suppose the ion is positive and is repelled from the ion. So it does not attach itself from the drop. If it tries to come in from the other side, which you'd say, oh, it'll come in on the other side. Don't forget the drop is falling through the air, so there's air drift going backwards, which carries the ions away if they move slowly enough. That's why we have to say the large, slow-moving ion. So the large, slow-moving ions will not, of positive sign, will not attach themselves either onto the front or the back. On the other hand, the negative ions, which are large and slow, will, as they come to the front of the drop, be directly attracted and come in. And therefore, the drop will acquire a negative charge, the sign of the charge having been determined by the original potential difference on the entire Earth. And it's the right sign. Negative charge will be brought down to the bottom parts of the cloud by the drops, and the positive charge, these ions, which are left without their negative counterparts, will be blown to the top of the cloud by the various updraft currents. This has the right sign, and everything looks very good about this theory. It doesn't require only that it be water. You can show, as we will learn about polarization in a dielectric, that pieces of ice will do the same thing, will be also have positive and negative charges on their terminals when you have a voltage difference across them. It's nice that this theory is. There are some problems. First of all, the total charges involved in the thunderstorms are very high. And after a short time, you will have run out of ions. The large ions, there won't be any more. But Wilson and others have proposed that there are new sources of the large ions. You see, once the volt, the thing starts, very large electric fields are developed. And in these large fields, you get a phenomena at sharp points or other places called brush discharges. For example, if there's a highly charged drop or a point or something, let's say any point on the top of a steeple in a strong electric field, there's a very strong field in this location. When there's a strong enough electric field, electrons will pick up a lot of speed between collisions, so much so that in hitting another atom, they will tear electrons off of that atom, and you get a picture like this. Electron comes along, picks up speed, knocks a couple of more electrons from other atoms, leaving positive charges behind, and these then pick up speed and knock some more electrons, and so in a kind of chain reaction or avalanche, there's a rapid discharge. This will go on, of course, but the positive charge is then being left in the region. And so the positive charge on the point is then being distributed, if you will, after a little bit of this discharge, into a region around the point. And then, of course, there's no longer a strong field, and it stops. This is the character of a brush discharge. It is possible, of course, that when the fields become stronger, and we might have, with stronger electric fields, a little bit of brush discharge, a few electrons coming in by brush discharge, leaving positive ions behind, which are blown away. And there may be, in other words, many mechanisms, once the thing is started, because of the large fields, to produce a large amount of ionization. The details of this thing, however, have not been satisfactorily, nobody knows exactly how the thing works. So the fundamental origin of lightning is really not thoroughly understood. We know it comes from the thunderstorms. The thunder, of course, we know, comes from the lightning, from the energy of the bolt. Let me now describe the lightning. Again, we don't understand exactly how it works. And I'll give a brief qualitative description of what it looks like, and then we won't go into any details of how it works. The way to find this out is to take a camera which has a very rapidly rotating mirror and to look at a lightning stroke, but expose it onto the film, spreading it out, so that the light, if, for instance, a stroke repeats, then there will be two independent images. And in this way, what happens is a function of time has been found out. And I'll describe only the ordinary case of a negative cloud and the Earth underneath. The Earth is positive relative to the cloud. Of course, it's negative usually, but it's so cloud is so much negative. The Earth is positive. And what happens is the following. There's a thing called a leader, which begins, which is not as bright as the stroke of lightning. It's called a stepped leader. What happens is there's a little bit of a thing comes down that you can see in a photographic plate with a little bright spot at the end, and it comes down very rapidly at a sixth of the speed of light. It goes about 50 meters or so. It varies a lot. It varies a lot. It goes about 50 meters and pauses. Pauses there for 50 microseconds, and then does another one. And then it pauses, and then so on. So in a series of steps, and sometimes it decides to try a new track. So in a series of steps, it goes toward the ground. And finally, this leader comes to the ground. Now, in the leader, of course, the negative charge of the cloud is leaking out. And so this whole column is full of negative charge. Also, of course, what's happening is that the air is becoming ionized by the moving charges having torn up the air molecule, so that the air up here becomes a conductor and it carries a negative charge down to here. So the moment it touches the ground, we have a conducting wire, like a conductor, that runs all the way up to the cloud, and furthermore is full of negative charge. Now at last, unlike the case when it was part way up where it can't escape, now the negative charge can simply escape and run out. What happens? The negative charge, which is right here, is the first one that finds out. And it dumps out and leaves positive charge behind in the column, which attracts more negative charge from here, which dumps out and which pours out, so that all the negative charge runs out of this whole column in a rapid and energetic way. Leaving, when it does so, it makes a very bright light emission and an awful lot of heat and an expansion which makes the thunder and so on. But a lightning stroke, you see, if you could see it in the camera, runs backwards from the ground. The main stroke, the brightest part, is called a return stroke, in fact. So the bright part runs backwards from the ground. Incidentally, when it comes from a branch, if the branch itself, the other end of the branch itself, hasn't reached the ground, otherwise there's a competition problem. But if it reaches the branch, a branch which hasn't reached the ground by the time this end reached the ground, the lightning stroke goes up the branch to the end. So when you see a flash, it looks like this. What's happened is it's gone back up here, down into here. How? Because this charge is running down here too. You see, all the negative charge is finding its way to the earth. So this whole branch is poured back down. And while that's happening, of course, electricity is pouring back all the way up here until it gets in the cloud, and it comes in from the cloud too. So a lightning stroke runs backwards up from the ground. I mean, but the leader comes down from the sky. If it wasn't to the Empire State Building or some specially large object on the ground. This is a simple case where the ground is relatively flat. After this happens, this thing lights up a little bright and then goes out. And after a varying time of a few hundredths, perhaps a tenth of a second, I guess it's closer to a few hundredths, another leader will come down. This is the same picture, but I'm just drawing it over again. The lightning has gone. It's all disappeared. And then another leader comes down, but this time there are no steps. It's called a dark leader this time, and it goes all the way down, right from the top to the bottom, full steam, on the old track, on exactly where the old track, because there's enough debris in there to make it the easiest route. It comes down, again a leader, full of negative charge. The moment it touches the ground, zing, there's a return stroke going straight up and down, up that same thing. So you see the lightning strikes again and again and again, sometimes only once or twice, sometimes 5 or 10 times. The largest number has been measured as 42 times in the same place, but in rapid succession. Incidentally, sometimes you get more complicated circumstances if a branch happens to have reached the ground practically simultaneously in the original stroke. It can sometimes happen that the dart leader takes the other branch, and so you get the first flash one place and the other one another place, but it's a special case of the same idea. The currents in lightning strokes are about 10,000 amperes at the peak, and they carry down about 20 coulombs. Of course, you appreciate the fact that this has been slightly simplified when it comes to the ground. I must say that that when it gets very close to the ground, when the step leader gets within 50 meters or 100 or so meters from the ground, then there's evidence that the thing rises from the ground, because then the field is getting so big you can get a discharge up from the ground, so you meet it. And if, of course, there are sharp objects like a building with a sharp point at the top, then as the thing comes down nearby, the fields are so large here that
The discharge starts from this point and it reaches to the leader, and so the thing strikes the points. With regard to this fact that high objects are struck by lightning, this is a fact which has been apparently known for a long time. Before there I have a quotation of Artabanus, the advisor to Xerxes, is giving him advice, because when he was contemplating attacking the Greeks so that the Persians would be control the entire world known at that time. And Artabanus says, "See how God with his lightning always smites the bigger animals and will not suffer them to wax insolent, while those of a lesser bulk chafe him not. How likewise his bolts fall ever on the highest houses and tallest trees." And he explains the reason, you see. "So plainly does he love to bring down everything that exalts itself." I hear some laughter. Do you think then, now that you're knowing a truer cause of lightning striking tall trees, that you have a greater wisdom in advising kings on military matters than Artabanus had 2,300 years ago? Don't exalt yourself. You could only do it less poetically. Thank you. Well, yes, I know you gave me a different explanation, and I thought about it, and I don't believe yours, so I made up my own. Let's discuss it. What's yours? The charge actually leaves the plate?
Yeah, there is a flow, actually a flow of current from this thing to the stream.
How do you know?
Oh, it's certainly a conductivity in the air.
You're very small, yes.
Yeah, but you don't need much charge.
I see.
I think that the
polarization
phenomenon.
That's what I described it.
Yes, but I think the charge is of the same sign, pretty much the same sign on all the droplets. That's what makes
it. Have you measured it?
No, you.
No, but it seems to me that, I just thought it was hard to believe.
You don't think it's just an inductive effect? Because if any charge that leaks off is going to go to him.
He gets charged too, of course, it runs right off.
Why is the charge running back up here?
There's a negative charge in the column. You mean the lightning running back?
Why is it running back up?
It's not the lightning that goes up, it's what you see goes up. The brightness goes up.
The brightness goes up.
That's right.
There's a flow of electrons.
That's right. You have this whole column full of electrons. Mm-hmm. And the ones at the bottom are the first ones to discover that they can escape.
Yeah.
So they run out, and then the ones further up run out, and the ones further up run out. You see, it just, imagine a pipe, a tray full of water, and you open a hole at one end. Then there's a wave, so to speak, of minus water, which runs up. And the fast-moving charges make a bright spark, you see, make the bright light, the ones that are roaring down through here. And so these roaring ones work their way back up to the column. That's right. And the brightness, the place that looks bright works its way up. And you see, that's interesting, it works its way down the branch. Because it's dumping. The whole thing is pouring out from the negative charge.
How come the whole cloud doesn't discharge at once? Did you get a number of strokes?
Well, it's very likely that only a relatively small fraction, like perhaps a fifth or so of the charge of the cloud is destroyed by this. Of course, there is a big problem altogether of the whole thing, and that is how inside the cloud the various charges are collected together to pour down this thing. There must sort of be internal little strokes. So you have to gather the charge together, the charge in different places. So presumably what happens is that you discharge a piece, the only parts where the field is strong enough to break the air down so that the charge can move in. You see, the air is fundamentally an insulator until the voltages, the fields get too big, and then it sparks over. Well, you've dumped a part of the charge of the cloud, but there's other pieces further over, and they haven't got that big a field, presumably.
Well, then why?
And then gradually it finds out about it. You've dumped this out of here, and the fields build up again from one way or another, and then it discharges to here from another part of the cloud, and then down the old channel, probably.
But why does that happen in this tenth of a second?
Nobody knows the details of these things, and if you want some good subject to study, why, that's a good one, because there's a lot of possibility you could think of something new in this field. How long it should take before the next stroke, and what's happening in the cloud, and how the charges are gathered to pour down inside the stroke is not at all been thought out very carefully and isn't known at all. In fact, the details, as far as I can tell, but I haven't had time, unfortunately, to look all the way through the literature to find out whether the phenomenon of the stepped leader is understood. In all the books that I read, it was not understood. And this were books up to about 1958 or so. But see, I couldn't get the references at the most recent, so I was in a poor position. I couldn't say nobody knows, because I don't know if they figured it out. So I can't tell. So I'll have to maybe give another talk later on sparks or something like that, and then I'll find out better what's known. But I don't think that the phenomenon of why it goes in steps in the first place is understood.
Have you ever read The Inexplicable Sky by, I think, Arthur Constance?
No.
It's just filled with all
inexplicable things.
Yeah, yeah, it's like ball lightning primarily. Has there ever been any kind of explanation published on that?
I believe that in recent years there has been one, but I don't remember whether it was a joke or true. I know a man who, I don't really know. Maybe Sands, Matt,
yes.
Do you know anything about ball lightning? I once heard that Wilson had an explanation. Was he joking, or is it true, or have I...
Well, he thinks it's real.
Uh-huh.
And, he doesn't have an explanation. He searched literature and trying to find out what its properties are. And found that it seems he's
consistent
that they exist and they run around and they come through windows and they bounce through
the door. They do. Well, Arthur Constance has a lot. And well
documented. He's looking into it because he thought, well, he is a...
Oh, but he didn't get an explanation.
I don't think he got an explanation.
Oh, as far as I know, there's no explanation.
Well, yeah. I've seen it because it blew a hole in a shed roof right next to my window one.
Lightning or ball of light?
Boom.
Yeah, really?
Wow.
I have a friend who saw it.
Charlie
just last
area,
summer.
You know. Oh, brother, it was a mess.
What color was it?
It was kind of a greenish blue, you know, color that you associate with ozone. Uh-huh. Ooh, and the air stank.
Everybody else finds it's red. You see, that's the way those things go.
Well, this one was a greenish, it was during the rain, yeah, so that would have made sense.
Well, it may be, yes. People have variations in there. But because it happens so fast and nobody can figure when it's going to happen, they haven't figured out how to make an experiment to make it, you see. So nobody knows the explanation of ball lightning.
What's the explanation of this? I think that a very recent attempt at explaining it on the basis of a coarse three field configuration.
The attempt, but I think it will succeed.
Well, not in detail. On the other hand, I think that what we know about pilots of the coarse three field thing indicates that if you had a very complex system of currents with its own built-in magnetic field, it could contain an awful lot of energy and might exist for some time.
Well, yeah, there's a might and a maybe, but I'd like to...
When it comes to a metallic object.
Yeah.
Because this is an observed thing, that it bounces in the window and then it goes over to the bedstead, and then you've got charred paint on your bedstead or your metal shed roof or something.
But... Well, I don't feel that's an explanation.
It's true that
In Illinois, we have a phenomenon. A lot of during hot, humid days or nights, actually, you can see along the horizon lightning jumping from what looks like from cloud to cloud.
But yes.
It never comes down. It never discharges against the earth.
How do you know it never discharges against the earth?
Well, at least you can never see.
Well, it's far away on the horizon.
That's true.
So you might have been not so sure.
Furthermore,
it's true that there are many strokes from one cloud to another. In fact, probably more than there are off to the ground.
But you can't see them when you're under them.
Ordinarily, the clouds are thick and you don't see them. And what you call, there are various kinds of lightning, like sheet lightning and heat lightning.
Heat lightning, yeah.
And so on. But those are real thunderstorm lightning. It's the same thing, but it's at a distance in the clouds and lights up the clouds and you don't see the strokes.
I see. So it's
but it's the same phenomenon. What you call heat lightning is really thunderstorms at a great distance that you see the lightning flashes. There's no other kind of lightning. There's sheet lightning, there's beaded lightning, and there's forked lightning, and there's ball lightning, of which only ball lightning is mysterious, deeply mysterious. The bead lightning is not so clear. It has that on the stroke there are sort of lumps of brighter points, but it's been suggested that it has something to do with the
the way the streamers, the streamer heads have stopped, or some other such thing.
Or the difference in the air or something.
Yeah.
Because wouldn't the beams be due to the...
Well, I don't know. It happens once in a while. And then there's forked lightning, but it turns out that forked lightning is apparently lightning that I already explained, that it takes one track, and then it comes down on the second stroke.
Why
on
would
another,
it go both ways?
But when it's struggling to find out where it's going down, it breaks down in a sort of irregular way, these avalanches. And so maybe it breaks down in this way, and then at the same time one is started this way. Then once this is started, there's a strong field at its end, and it just keeps on going. It like a... So you get something like this. Now, if while this is going, if they both strike the ground at almost the same time, or for instance, this strikes the ground, and before the lightning stroke, which we were talking about, can work its way up to here and just get the negative charge from here and work its way back, this could reach the ground. It's got an independent existence, because it takes time for it to find out that the other guy... So you can often have the strokes both hitting the ground, one first and then the other, before the lightning has got its way back. When that happens, it often is the case that sometimes the case that the second stroke will not necessarily, the next dart leader won't necessarily go on the original stroke, but it'll take this one. And then you get a very bright light on here too, all the way to the ground, and you get what you call forked lightning. But as far as people can tell, it's not a spark with a fork in it, but it's a succession of very rapid that the eye can see, a bing, and then one with another track, you see.
Can you recommend a book which has some photographs like the ones you were describing?
Photographs.
You know, the ones...
Oh, yes.
You can see the leaders and so on.
I'm going to put back in the library a book called where I got all the stuff from, most of it. I read several other books to make sure, because it was only 1953 and I had to make sure that things haven't changed. So it's a lot of work in this. But it's a big thing called Compendium of Meteorology, and it's a reference book in the bottom of the physics library, and it tells about all kinds of problems in meteorology written in 1953. Then there's a book called Atmospheric Electricity, which I read by Chalmers. It's very difficult to read because it's one of these books where the man is not at all critical. He's working in a field where nobody knows the answer to anything. So everything is allowed in the book, you see. The book will consist of a section on the charge carried by rain, you see, and then on calm days, and it'll say something like this. Schmultz has measured the charge carried by rain and finds it to be negative so-and-so much per drop. Spiegelhead has measured, he finds it a different value, different sign. And he goes right on and he just describes what the guy's measuring. And he doesn't say which one is more likely, which one is less likely. But it's a pretty good book because it's complete, at least in showing the chaos of the information on these. I forgot to mention that the electric charges carried by the drops by the time they reach the ground are not very high. I mean, not very definite. You'd think from one of the theories they all be negative. But they're not. Some of them are plus and some of them are minus, and it's quite
a... I noticed on the diagram it said area of light, positive rain, and then area...
Yeah, that's exaggerated. But that's one of those things they would like to have.
Oh.
But it's not guaranteed by other measurements that it's always consistently that in the center of the thunderstorm it's the positive and other place a negative. All they know is that some people measure plus and some people measure minus, and they're not exactly sure as to what the conditions are that make a difference. And this guy presumably taking a guess.
Why doesn't the cloud always discharge from the bottom to the top?
Why doesn't it?
Yeah.
It does from time to time, lightning. Usually, however, somewhat sideways. Huh?
Seems like it'd be a lot more likely.
Perhaps it is.
Because the top of the...
Well, the top is further away. There are strokes inside the cloud, yes. What?
Wilson theory of charging the droplet.
Yeah.
Self-perpetuating the other.
Yes, that's right. Isn't that interesting? But once it started, there's no way to get out from under.
Yeah.
But after all, it's got to start somehow. I mean, by an accident, like our dopey machine or the static machines, they always start somehow.
It worked just as well the other way around.
Yes, it would apparently work just as well. Although Wilson has given an argument to indicate why the first thunderstorms would make it the other way, but who? In the beginning, but it's kind of crazy. The argument having to do with the relative speed mobility of positive and negative ions, that negative ions move a little bit faster than positive ones, so that the currents, I didn't mention the currents at the top. You see, at the top of a cloud, here's the cloud, there also must be currents up in here. that match the currents down here. And he's talking about the fact that it's easier that those which happen to have the charge so that this side is positive would be more rapidly discharged, make their connection than the others because of the mobility of the different signs of ions. But that's one of those things. You've got two possibilities, and you appreciate that if it locks itself in one or the other, it's stuck. And since there are only two possibilities, there's not much to work with in the theory. Yeah.
You can't try it all over again.
Yeah.